Good morning, everyone. Welcome to ECFR. We're going to have this morning a bit of a meta level discussion compared to our usual discussions. Instead of discussing the issues, we're going to discuss how the media cover the issues. And in particular, John Lloyd and Christina Marconi have written this very interesting report on how the EU institutions are covered on behalf of the Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism, which is based on around 30 interviews with current and former Brussels correspondents, and sheds interesting light, I think, on how the correspondents see themselves and also how they see each other, which is quite interesting. The remarks by Jean Quatremer are quite good, I thought.
You're legaling that.
Yeah. And it also shed some light on the sort of challenges that Brussels correspondents face. One of the things that might be interesting to pick up in the discussion that you touch on is the difference between the way that the EU is covered in Britain and elsewhere in the EU. We can maybe come back to that. But also what I think might be interesting would be to discuss a bit how coverage of the EU has changed since the crisis began, which again you touch on in the report. One of the issues that comes up again and again is the sort of difficulty that reporters face in covering the EU because it's so complex and perceived as being boring by editors in their own member states. But also that it's seen as being irrelevant somehow, was seen as being irrelevant. It seems to me since the crisis, suddenly actually Europe became interesting and important in a different way. On the other hand, you had this sort of outpouring of collective memory and this very aggressive media coverage in some member states. And I'm thinking particularly of the coverage of Greece in Germany and Germany in Greece as probably the most extreme example. About a year or so ago when Anthony Giddens was here, I can't remember if either of you two were here for that discussion, but he talked about how he thought that since the crisis began, actually for the first time a European public sphere has emerged, which I thought was quite interesting. I wasn't actually convinced about that, but again, perhaps that's something we can pick up again in the discussion. In other words, is the crisis a kind of an opportunity for media coverage of the EU? John and Christina are going to introduce the report a little bit first, and then Sarah Hobolt is going to respond. Hopefully we'll get through those introductory statements in sort of 25 minutes or so, and then we can have a long discussion afterwards. Christina.
Okay. So for me, as a former correspondent in Brussels, it was very interesting to see how my own job evolved over time, because usually Brussels is considered to be a very clubby place by other correspondents. It's a very different assignment from others. So it has been very interesting to have a look at the story of correspondents in Brussels. And what we've discovered is that in the 60s, late 50s, beginning of 60s, there were very few correspondents. And it was mainly like newswire being there. And when the press room increased the number of correspondents, those people were mainly relatives of officials or relatives of diplomats and people who already belonged to Brussels. So for some decades, Brussels was benefiting from a coverage which was mainly friendly and very supportive because the project was perceived as being very positive overall. There was a post-war atmosphere. It was a peaceful, positive, perceived as positive even by Fleet Street editors. So there have been like some main turning points. One of those was in the 90s when a new generation of reporters arrived, and because the previous ones were simply older. And they kind of injected some investigative culture into the reporting of the institutions. At the beginning, there were, like, in the 60s, 12 correspondents for 300 officials, and they were living together, sharing the same space. In the 90s, of course, like, with the enlargement, the arrival of the Scandinavian countries, the journalistic culture changed a lot. I must say that when I arrived there in 2006, this characteristic of being a little bit clubby, secluded from the rest of the world, was still there. One of the main reasons to that is that those who cover the European Union have more difficulties maybe than other journalists, because they have to deal with the language, which is very difficult, with like a whole range of Brussels European expressions, which aren't always easy to understand for the wider public. And the Brussels correspondents have to, on one hand, understand what those expressions mean and try to convey them to the bigger public to explain. What happens is that very often people who stay there for a very long time kind of forget to translate this for the wider public. So, doing like my very short timeline of European journalism, then like there was the, we're talking about the 90s, then in 2005 there were like the French and Dutch referendum, and there was a little bit of a shock, big shock for the European reporting, and there was like some elements of Euroscepticism were introduced even from the continental press. Because when it comes to Brussels, I think a very important thing is to consider that each and every country tend to tell its own story. And it is one of the most surprising things. Sometimes reading the same story reported by different newspapers can be kind of a shocking experience. In the last years, something very, I think, quite revolutionary happened. Because of the crisis, the debt crisis, some elements of Euroscepticism were introduced even in, were much more widespread than they were before. When I say Euroscepticism, I'm not like meaning that the pro-European reporters are not critical and that there haven't been like elements of criticism in the past. I think the main difference is on the perception and the way people tell and explain about the future of the European Union. So we've been seeing in the last four to five years many editorials saying that maybe it's time to reconsider the role of the European Union. There has been a lot of questioning about its future. And I must say that it is something which is surprising compared to what was going on in Brussels even only 10 years ago. So there has been, I would say, a normalization of the reporting in Brussels. It has been, it has become much more like any other assignment. And when I think about like what the crisis, the debt crisis, changed in the way the story, the European story is told, I think the main differences are that Brussels is not only reported by Brussels correspondents anymore, which wasn't really the case before, because it was very, I mean, there was like almost an aspect of being like a Brussels correspondent was a high priest who was, you know, allowed to understand a certain sphere of things, which other political reporters could not understand. So, and also the relation between member states has become much stronger, because at some point what happened is that you had Greek news were just as important as home news for many media. So I think, I mean, even though we went very close to a disaster at some point, I think it has been very beneficial to see what happened in the last years, because every journalist had as a task to explain to a much more interested public what was going on. And but I think, I mean, I'm trying to do an historical introduction, but maybe John can tell us more about the challenges and the other aspect.
Thanks, Christina. Commercial first. The Reuters Institute for the Study of Journalism, one of the things that we do there And one of the main lines of approach we take is to try to understand how journalism deals with power, with political power, first of all, but with all forms of power, corporate power, and others. And we started with the assumption, when we were doing this piece on the reporting of the European Union, that the European Union and the various institutions around it was, and is, one of the most important centres of power in the world, and the most innovative in the sense that it claims to have governance, some kind of governance, over now 28 sovereign states. So it's quite a unique institution, it's a powerful institution, and what journalists say about themselves when they're in their Sunday best is that we hold power to account. And thus, what we were looking at was how far journalism off Europe and about the European Union holds that institution and its associated institutions to account. And we found, first, that there is a huge amount of information available about the European Union, much of it renewed every day. It comes from the world business papers like the FT, Economist, Wall Street Journal, comes from the big wire services like Bloomberg and Reuters. It comes from the specialized, some 30 or 40 specialized websites and journals which write only about the European Union or the European Council and so on. And it comes from the huge flow of material that comes out of the press relations side of the European Union. So if you want to be informed about the European Union, you're in paradise. You've got a huge amount from which you simply can't read everything that comes out every day. On the other hand, in the popular media, the most popular medium for news is television, and the popular newspapers in Europe, there's very little. The assumption, as Christina said, is that the assumption of editors, both in television and in newspapers, is it's boring. You put Europe in the title or on the top of the bulletin, and people will switch off or move on to another story. That's changed, again, as she said, in the last few years because of the euro crisis. People have wanted to know what's happening because it's their future, it's their financial position. So it's changed a bit. It's also got more dramatic. I mean, a number of the people we spoke to were TV journalists, and they all said what's wrong with Europe is that the kind of film you can get is middle-aged man in grey suit comes out of car, goes into building. Middle-aged man in grey suit comes out of building, goes into car. And the Parliament, until now, thanks to Nigel Farage and associated parties elsewhere, but until then, the Parliament was pretty dull. Again, a TV correspondent said that when someone tells a joke, which is rare, you can hear it ripple around the hall until, in the final analysis, 2 minutes later, the Estonians get it and laugh, or not, as the case may be. So it's difficult to cover. It's difficult for the popular press. There are no, I think Bild Zeitung, which is the most popular paper in Europe in terms of sales, has a correspondent but doesn't come very often. And the tabloids in this country don't have correspondents. They did have, but then withdrew them, and they write most of the stuff from the editorial suites. So as far as understanding for a broad general audience, there isn't much. Of course, the broad general audience can access the material that's on the web. Nearly all of it is on the web, but most people don't. Again, footnote to Christina once again, there's been a problem about comprehension. When the crisis broke, the press corps in Brussels, which is quite numerous, although it's fallen a bit, and there are many more freelancers than there used to be, and fewer full-time correspondents. But when it broke, they realised that most of them were not financial specialists, and especially for those who were a one-man or woman bureau without much backup from head office, which is at least half, then they had nobody to turn to. And for months, and nearly all of the people we spoke to, especially the ones who were on their own, attested to this. For months, they were fumbling. They just didn't understand what, as one TV reporter told us, actually the politicians themselves who sat around the table and passed motions didn't understand the complexity of the mechanisms which were being discussed. We found out that the wise saying that all politics is local is true in the sense that nearly all papers, again apart from those who take the Globe as their oyster, nearly all papers and TV channels essentially treat Europe as what's Europe doing to us and what are we doing to it. And much of the material that appears comes from briefings made by the press relations people or the ministers or the prime minister of the given country after a meeting. In other words, Spaniards get Spanish EU news, Brits get British EU news. The Germans actually are a bit different. One, they cover it much more fully than anybody else, and to a degree at least, they treat it as a European-wide institution rather than as simply as a German appendage. This at this time, but other people think it's a German appendage, but the Germans don't think that and treat it as an important institution. Finally, Hans mentioned that Britain is regarded as being the Eurosceptic place. It is the Eurosceptic place. It's where Eurosceptic journalism was nurtured, was created, especially by The Sun under Kelvin Mackenzie in the 1980s. And perhaps even above all, most famously by Boris Johnson, when he, at the end of the 80s, I think it was the 4 years, the Daily Telegraph's correspondent. And he claims, with his habitual modesty, that he actually, Sarah might know this better, yeah, that he changed the course of the Danish referendum. It was a Danish referendum on the constitution, I think it was.
Maastricht.
And he had written a story, not for a Danish paper, but for the Sunday Telegraph front page story, saying that Delors had a secret plan to rule Europe and to cancel out national governments. This went down well in the Sunday Telegraph, but it also went down well in Denmark, where it was reprinted, and in a very tight vote, the vote went against endorsing Maastricht, and Boris later said that he had saved the Danish people from a fate worse than death. He still does say that, but he said it at the time. And Charles Grant, who was a friend of his and was then the Economist correspondent, says that he believes it. So British Euroscepticism is powerful, is now, as Christina said, beginning to catch on a bit, and remains extremely powerful here. And is catching on in part because the Parliament, which is now much more exciting, has got many more Eurosceptics in it. Thanks.
Thank you very much, John and Christina. So, Sarah, apart from telling us whether Boris Johnson did in fact save the Danish people from a fate worse than death, maybe you could give us your general response on the report. But also, I was very struck by what John said at the beginning about the focus of the Reuters Institute being about how journalism deals with power. I wondered whether you think that, one of the things we've been debating over the last couple of years at ECFR, and I think are still debating, is the extent to which the crisis has changed the sort of power relations within the EU, in particular whether there has been a shift back, as it were, from Brussels back to the member states. And you point out actually in the report that there has been a kind of shift in the way that reporting works, so that actually now a lot of coverage of the EU takes place in Berlin and so on, Frankfurt.
Yeah.
But I wondered if you had any thoughts about whether the media in Europe sort of exaggerate in some particular direction the shift in power, or whether they distort it, or do they accurately reflect the sort of division, as it were, the distribution of power within Europe?
Well, yeah, I'll certainly reflect on that. I just want to start by congratulating Christina and John on an excellent book. I mean, I assume most of you in the room haven't read it yet, but I'll say it's not only, as we've heard, informative, but it's also very engaging and certainly much better written than anything I normally read in the academic circle. So it was really, it was just really a joy. It's like a real sort of page turner, and that's, I normally don't have time to read those. So it was great that I had the opportunity to do that for this event. And as we've heard, it's very informative and really give a rare inside glimpse into how, you know, news reporting on the EU comes about, how it's evolved over time, and in particular an in-depth look at the British, the German and the Italian in particular, but also going beyond that, reporting on the EU. Well, we've heard that and you will enjoy reading it, no doubt. So I wanted to look a bit from a slightly different perspective in terms of some of the things we've heard about of the role of the media. Because as someone, as a political scientist studying democracy in the EU and so, the media we know have, of course, a crucial role. And it's very much debated what role the media plays in terms of shaping public opinions and public attitudes towards the EU. We like to think here in Britain, I think, that Britain is sort of unique and an outlier. And in some sense, the British press might be, but the British people, in terms of its Euroscepticism, is not, and the kind of outlier that we might often think it is. So in that sense, of course, the British press and the European press has a role in shaping attitudes, but it's also catering to a demand. Now, that kind of balance, how much is it shaping attitudes and how much is it trying to sell newspapers by catering to that? You know, that's an open debate. But certainly with the EU, maybe perhaps more than other institutions, the press is important because few people have sort of a direct day-to-day interaction. It's not like you can go to the NHS doctor and that makes you form an opinion about the health. So with the EU, the press is really, because the EU is so distant, the press is really important. And here, I think the crisis offered both an opportunity and a challenge for the media, in the sense that all of a sudden this became, the EU became the very salient issue, not only to sort of day-to-day policy buffs, you know, or those of us in this room who think this is terribly exciting, but, you know, to people across Europe. And what we see, if we look at trends in reporting, so this book, of course, focuses on the input, but there's also an output side, there is a huge and massive increase in the reporting on the EU across television and newspapers. And it does a couple of things. So is there a lot of debate in political science about sort of democracy in the EU? It's about, do we need one public sphere in order to have an electoral democracy? So some people argue you could never really have democratic institutions at the European level because you need one common public sphere where we discuss in one language and we have one set of political actors that are competing with different views. Now, there is a sort of more moderate view to that, saying we don't really need that. I mean, look at Switzerland, one of the most successful democracies, they might argue. I mean, they can't normally speak to each other. They certainly don't have one public sphere. But what we need is a sort of a parallelization of public spheres. In other words, that the same issues are debated across Europe. So not necessarily that we all debate in one form and read the same newspapers and watch the same television channels, but at least we're debating similar issues. And that's what happened in the crisis. Similar issues were debated, but as we've heard, from slightly different perspective often. So that's the challenge. You know, if it becomes this sort of football match or slinging match with these lazy, sleazy Greeks versus the domineering sort of empire-expanding Germans, and that's the newspaper. In a sense, it might be parallel public spheres, but in fact, it's rather undermining maybe to the message. What happened, though, is that we certainly did have also the emergence of something that rarely happened, which is European actors emerging. And you can probably guess who the one person who was non-national who appeared most across Europe in the media was. And she's, in fact, here on the front page here. It was Angela Merkel. So she became the one figure, I guess, in parts of Europe as the savior, in other parts maybe not. So it's interesting. So therefore, it's an opportunity because all of a sudden people paid attention, but it's also a challenge because what happened was that, you know, it was portrayed from these very different perspectives that meant that really perhaps it created further divisions. So just a few things. So I thought, you know, this was really excellently portrayed. There were a couple of things that, you know, I would like to hear more about. Also, one thing I thought, the front end of this book focuses very much on the Eurosceptic media, so I was a bit saddened that there weren't much discussion of how the journalists from this kind of tabloid media, how they come up with their stories. And perhaps it's because, exactly, you know, as you wrote, they're not in Brussels. Maybe they just sort of decide on the way to, on the tube, on the way to work, what to write, but it was nevertheless something I'd like to hear more about. another thing which I think is interesting, and perhaps because of the timing of the publication of this, but if you go to the Commission and the Parliament, one of the challenges they realize is this thing that, what, how do you show it on television? How do you portray it? You know, the Parliament building or a middle-aged man going in and out of a building is not interesting. So one of the things they wanted with this 2014 European Parliament elections and these lead candidate or Spitzenkandidaten, which is, you know, just that name, it's never going to sell in the British media, you know, it's German for a starter. But, you know, that was going to create that. Okay, the three top candidates were middle-aged sort of grey men, so that might not have helped. But the idea at least that you could put a face, not just the sort of the face of a leader of a member state, but the face of a European politician. And here again we see the division in the media, because in Britain this was only covered after the event. Mm-hmm. I remember sitting on the BBC election night and saying, Juncker is going to be the story next week. He's going to be all over. And they were like, who is Juncker? Like, who's this person? You know, we have to look in our archives to see if we can find a photo. I mean, and this was on the election night. Of course, in Germany, this had been a huge story in the campaign. I mean, granted, because Martin Schulz was one of the candidates, but also because, so here, this idea that, you know, there was trying to create contestation at a European level. And here again, of course, the media plays an important role trying to pick up that, because there was an opportunity to make it about something maybe a bit more sexy and exciting than, you know, the next directive from the Parliament. So I'll end it there, because the people in the room obviously knows much more about that. But from a sort of the perspective of political science, I thought this was just a great book.
Thanks, Sarah. So you seem, in fact, all three of you to be suggesting that actually the way that the crisis has, in a sense, been a positive development. It's made it easier in some ways for journalists to cover the EU. There are clearly problems with the parallel universes, as it were, the parallel stories, every country telling its own story. I'd like to push you, Sarah, in particular, a bit further on this idea of paralysation, as you put it. You were suggesting, if I understood you correctly, that actually isn't good enough if you have parallel stories. You need a kind of a convergence. Is that right?
Well, I mean, the problem as I see it is that if we want to, if the debate is only, there's always going to be a parallel. But let me sort of make the comparison perhaps with the United States. If we're going to have more powers to the European Parliament as we've had, and we're going to have voters sort of judging politicians on a European dimension, not just what they deliver for the national state. Just like in the US, we judge an American, if you're an American voter, you judge the American president, not just what he's done for Wisconsin, but also what he's done for the US. And there isn't really that information. I mean, no European voter or citizen would really be concerned with what Juncker has delivered for Europe. They're concerned with what Juncker has delivered for their country. And then there is then the competition, there's then the incentive for politicians to only deliver. I mean, of course, they should deliver for their natural constituents, but there's no incentive to really try and deliver at the European level.
Yeah, and you point out in the report that the sort of the transnational media, as you call it, sort of pan-European media, the FT, Wall Street Journal, Reuters, and so on, do cover the news from a sort of no man's land, as it were, from no particular national perspective.
From nowhere.
The Economist,
yes,
as well. Yeah. But what can the you also point out that there's limited readership for some of those media. What can the national, the more popular national media, The Sun and Bild, do in this situation?
I don't think they want to do anything, because, I mean, the thing about their coverage is that they don't have a correspondent. Clearly, these stories are absolutely more entertaining than the ones, the technical ones. So, I mean, they won the war. I remember a quote from a desperate spokesperson at the time of Boris Johnson, say, okay, I can rebut your stories, but you're funnier than I am, so people will read your stories. And so I don't think there is much you can do with that. Showing maybe a little bit more the interesting side of Europe, because the problem is that every time you do a pro-European story, there is a problem of legitimacy. And so it seems, particularly at the moment, that it's not good to do.
But what if they did want to? I mean, if you were the editor of The Sun, how could you improve this situation?
I think I agree with Christina. I wouldn't want to. I would write it on the way to the tube, because that sums up The Sun's view. The thing about popular newspapers is And of course, they're losing circulation hand over fist like everybody else, but they are popular. In other words, the people who run them are not fools. They know what people read and what they don't read. They do surveys all the time. People don't read about complex European issues. They read about shock, scandal, bribery, and the way in which the European Union is rubbing out British democracy. But by and large, they don't read anything else. What can you do? Well, the pro-European tabloids, the Daily Mirror is one, do try to run what you might call pro-European stories, and they write pro-European commentary, but they don't write it very much. It seems to me to be one of these insoluble or quasi-insoluble issues in journalism. How do you get over complexity of any kind in the European Union and anywhere else to a large audience? And especially as the world gets more and more complex and interdependent and so on, and there are fewer areas where you can pretend to have a simple solution. And by and large, you just have to keep on trying to put some context to, I don't speak German, but I'm told continually the German public television channels, ARD and ZDF, do a lot of contextualization in the news and put a lot in the news on what's happening behind the scenes. BBC does a certain amount. And I think that's the only way you can do it. We have to rely a lot on the public service television, public service the radio, in order to give the kind of background that people need to understand what's happening.
Okay. We have lots of journalists in the room, including some former Brussels correspondents.
Yeah.
John.
John Peet from The Economist, and I was a Brussels correspondent. One of the thoughts that I had hearing this discussion, and actually interestingly the fact that Merkel is on the cover, is that the media, to some extent, is reflecting changes that are taking place inside the European Union, and particularly during the crisis, but I think to some extent now, the fact that the European Council is, in my view, the dominant institution. And throughout the crisis, very few people ever reported what Barroso had said, or indeed what Van Rompuy had said. What they were interested in was what Merkel was saying, or Sarkozy was saying. And I think that also plays into one of the things that all three of you have said, which is that you tend to get 28 different stories. Mm-hmm. Because what happens is you have a European summit, there's a huge row about something, they come out at 2 or 3 in the morning, and they give 28 press conferences. Yeah. And you are bound to get the problem that Sarah alluded to. And the one example that I remember particularly, I remember talking to Nick Robinson about it, there isn't a BBC person here, is there? was Cameron's great veto of the fiscal compact, which happened at sort of 4 o'clock in the morning in, I guess it was December 2011. And the BBC Today programme came straight out and said David Cameron has vetoed the treaty because he doesn't think it's good for Britain, and you know, this is a great sort of assertion of British will. Every other publication and news channel in Europe reported that the British basically weren't there, and everyone else had decided to go ahead with the fiscal compact without British participation. A completely different story. I'm not suggesting there's a solution to that, because it would be nice to get around it, but it is very difficult for media, particularly people who come into Brussels, as Nick said he did, not knowing a great deal about what the discussion means, and he's just told by Cameron, I've stood up and written and vetoed this treaty, he has to report that. So I think I do put some of the blame, at least on the political leaders who encourage this notion that it's a battle of the national country against Europe, and that's how we end up reporting it. That's not really a question, that's a comment. Sorry.
Mary.
I haven't worked out of Brussels, but I have worked out of other places. I've got a couple of points. One of them is from what John was saying. European leaders and European officials could actually help themselves in terms of coverage by not insisting on doing everything simultaneously. John talked about 28 press conferences. Well, that's true, but everybody wants to be first. So if you want to go to your national press conference, you can't go to hear, say, Merkel, or you can't go to hear Hollande. You have to plump for one or the other. And so you only get the others secondhand. And I think that is a real problem, because it means that the perspective is going to be national, despite everybody's best efforts, even if you want to be international. The second thing is just a permanent thing about journalism and foreign coverage. It's hugely difficult to get interest in something which is a process as opposed to something which is an event, or a single event, or a single crisis. Just keeping that in the news, keeping it as a process, is almost impossible. And the trouble is that the European Union is, to a large extent, a process rather than a series of events, and that keeps it, to a large extent, out of the news. The third thing I'd like to say is that I think coverage, first-hand coverage of Europe, has actually got worse in the UK because of the availability of direct information. 20 years ago, on the Astra satellite, you used to be able to get European television programmes broadcast for free in the UK. You can't do that now. On the Freeview platform, there is only the international stations, like Russia Today, like Al Jazeera. You don't even get Euronews on Freeview, let alone anything like France 24 or TF1 or any of the German channels. You do not get those. And I think that's a huge pity and a waste of an opportunity.
Thank you, Mary. There's one more question here.
Yeah, Martin Bond. For my sins, I used to brief Boris. I used to be especially from council back in the late 70s, up to 81. And it's the early days of Boris. And he took some months to make up his mind that he was going to be a nasty, well, a difficult person, not a nasty, but a difficult. He was always charming, but a difficult person in terms of reporting. And our answer in council was simply to clamp down on the information. He didn't get it. As simple as that, because he would turn it in the other way. But that's old history. What I'm concerned with now is that the assertion that there are 28 stories. There certainly aren't 28 stories in the big countries, and I don't even think there are 28 stories in the small countries. There's always a domestic story, quite clearly, and that's the first story. And for us, there are four or five other stories, or other people who contribute to aspects of the domestic story. Cameron is obviously the first story for us right now. Renzi is barely a story contributor for us, very barely. Hollande, yes, a bit more. Merkel, considerably more. And maybe Juncker, maybe Draghi. Yeah? We have five or six stories. We don't have 28 stories. Hmm. Brussels may have a problem in promoting aspects of 28 stories or trying to make them into one, but no single country has 28 stories, none at all. Mm-hmm. And this creation of the public sphere, the notion that it has to be all-inclusive for all 28, I think is trying to chase the myth. It only has to be a story that, roughly speaking, covers the major states that have big influence. Five, six, if you push it. Three, if you don't. And that really is where the story still is. I mean, it's not got wider than that. And I don't think in our lifetime, even around the audience here, I don't think in our lifetime it's going to go much beyond a hardcore of the big nations.
I'm going to take a couple more because they were mostly comments rather than questions, actually, even though they're journalists in the room. Stephen Castle.
Sorry, it's more comments.
That's fine, that's fine, it's fine.
Just a couple of points. One, to make a point about resources. It's actually quite difficult to write about Brussels, about the EU from Brussels, in a lively way. What you really need to do is travel around Europe. And as across the whole of Germany, resources are very tight and it's extremely difficult. I remember, I think at one point, the Independent of three star correspondents in Brussels, it is now only, apart from the FT, I think, one British paper that has a star correspondent. Everybody else is, some very good freelancers, the Independent, the Telegraph. But I think the Guardian is the only paper that has a permanently stationed star correspondent in Brussels. And if we think our problem is bad, look at the new member states.
Maybe it's stronger.
I can remember writing about the Latvian correspondent, who in the crisis, her salary was cut by half. She decided to stay and ended up as the sole correspondent, Latvian correspondent in Brussels. So any news, television, radio, newspapers, all came from Ines Sreznia. She was the only Latvian correspondent left in Brussels. And that has been a big collapse there. Second point, just to echo Mary's point on the complexity of the process, the process. I mean, in Britain, for example, at the moment, there's a legislative proposal from the government. You know it's going to get passed. So when the government publishes a bill, that's the basis for your story. In Brussels, when the Commission produces a proposal, inevitably it's going to aim big because it knows it's going to get watered down. So, you know, do you write it then? Do you then wait until it goes to the council when it is watered down, or to the parliament, or to conciliation? It's an extremely complicated process, and that's a real problem for journalists, because there are a limited number of times you can write a story with a big paragraph saying this is not the final version of it. You go to the minister. And a final point, just to explain, I was struck when I was writing, and I worked for the International Herald Tribune, but before that I was the York correspondent for The Independent, and just to explain the power of the tabloids combined with the Today programme. And this goes to this issue of legitimacy, I think, which is referred to, I think, in the book. If the Sun or the Mail came up with a big front page story, and the one I remember most vividly was about the Constitution, you know, at the end of 1,000 years of history, which suddenly appeared one day, and nothing particularly was going on in Brussels. From the Today point, newspaper programme's point of view, you get a Eurosceptic, and then you get a pro-European, and then you have political balance. But the agenda has been set by the Mail and the Sun. And it's then impossible to ignore that those stories. If they're running in the Mail and the Sun, and it's the top of the Today programme, it's completely impossible. Your editors are listening to that in London. So those newspapers, on the rare occasions that they do intervene in that regard, can be quite powerful, simply because that will get them on the media. There's then political balance, which satisfies the BBC, but then everybody else has to cover the story one way or another, and that the Eurosceptic agenda has started the day and will follow through.
Thanks. If any of you want to jump in, you know, on a sort of two-finger direct response, let me know. But in the meantime, William.
William Horsley. I covered several dozen summits from Brussels, and it seems to me that the big story of the rival media is actually the coverage of the EU process leading up to integration. In a way that reflects their national interest. And what we're talking about is that the British media, have the British media told the story of the climate which led up to the danger of British exit from the EU? And I think the answer probably is yes. In other words, there's an inevitability about this hostile coverage of the goings-on in Brussels and the EU. From trade protectionism to each of the treaties, which was basically forced down each British government's neck unwillingly. And I think that in the early years, there was a sense of ownership of the project, particularly by the founder nations, and that was reflected in their coverage. Mm-hmm. That, of course, they were pushing for a certain kind of EU. This came out very much during the convention, for example, where the British were the enemy. I was covering out of Germany for a long time, and the British were the enemy. I mean, the German politicians would say, well, let's dump the British, let's go ahead without them. So the politicians lost the plot together, it seems to me. So in a sense, that story was quite accurately told by... I would defend the British press don't always tell the national story. For example, they try to pin Tony Blair down about a domestic story at a press conference in 2001, and after that he never gave a press conference after an EU summit. He went to the little corner, the VIP corner, so that he could just brief the people that he wanted to and escape. So there was a certain holding to account there, but in a sense the story is, you know, this sense, would you agree with me that the national press have actually reflected this sense of ownership of the project until quite recently by the founder nations, and hostility from the periphery?
There was a question here at the back, and then one more here at the front, and did anyone, and Bill, and Agatha, okay.
Adam Steiners, I actually do have a question, and that is, have you had a chance to look at the backgrounds of any of these the journalists? I must admit, for instance, how many of you studied, for instance, Europe and States. I, I'm asking because I'm really trying to figure out how much they know. I'm not a journalist, but I used to comment a lot on the BBC, and I was struck by how little the people interviewing me knew. And I'm not tuning people around the table, of course, but I understand that BBC, for instance, did a kind of in-house, almost university, school, and tried to educate some of the journalists. So I'm just trying to get at that, the knowledge basis.
Okay.
I'm Mark English from the European Commission office here in London. I've got a small point of information and then a question. How do the tabloids get EU stories? Well, the main way, as I think is covered actually in the book to some extent, is that they're tipped off about the possibility not only of a story but of a negative angle by either a UKIP member or a Eurosceptic think tank or a Eurosceptic MEP of some sort, or sometimes MP. And then the story is written up, and the story might be EU to ban golf or tea bags or in Blyton. And the story is written up with that as the headline, Brussels to ban tea bags. And comments from a think tank, a Eurosceptic MP, often the same people who've given them the story, saying disgraceful attack on British way of life, maybe three or four of those. And then at the end, about an hour before their deadline, they will ring me, or someone like me, and they will ask for our angle from the Commission, and we will say this story is a load of baloney, and they will faithfully use our quote, always, without any distortion or any misrepresentation, and they'll do that right at the end, by which time most people have stopped reading. And that in a way, constitutes some kind of balance. And I wouldn't say that all of the stories created in this way are illegitimate. Some of them are actually good stories, and they do sometimes point to things that need to be addressed. So there's an element of genuine scrutiny there. So that's my kind of information point. My question is, would you like to say anything about the way that those who are expressing Eurosceptic views in the UK are held to account compared to those who are expressing pro-EU views? I'm thinking about the way that the press has gone very deeply into the background of Andrea Leadsom, mm-hmm. who is Eurosceptic but not an extreme Eurosceptic, and to contrast that with where they haven't looked into the very similar financial services backgrounds of some prominent people in UK, for example, and we just don't see those things.
Bill.
Thank you. Another former economist, Brussels correspondent. And I have a question, but I'll just make a small observation about news from nowhere. Which is a positive one. When I became Brussels correspondent many years ago, we actually had a separate mini section on the European Community, as it was then called. And I think one can count it as progress that John now edits a section called Europe, which the European Union is merely a part. In other words, not a special, alien, strange thing. But my question is this, which is a typical unfair question about a book that has a closing deadline. What one needs often in journalism is an enemy. Through much of the period when you were researching this, there were enemies within, particularly the lady on the cover. Since then, you've got an enemy without, in the name of Vladimir Putin. And I'm wondering if you have any observations about the way in which the crisis in Ukraine has played in coverage of the European Union and of the European countries. Has the enemy without offer
their unified. Great. Agata and then Malcolm, I think that's going to have to be it.
I'm not Kevin Flora at all, but I was social policy editor of The Guardian for several decades. And that, just to put this in this perspective a bit, if you look at social policy, they don't get reported. Not even big stories. When Tony Blair decided he was going to end child poverty with a big Toynbee speech, got very, very little coverage at all. Because there was no political dispute about it. So Europe may need enemies. Social, homegrown stories need political disputes. And then beyond that, news desks until UKIP were telling the political Westminster correspondents were in despair that the degree to which news desks were saying, look, people don't like political stories. You know, being removed back to the back page, to the more inside pages of the... So I'm not saying that it isn't bad. I'm not saying Europe is probably more poorly covered than social policy, but it affects much more areas as well as Europe. And lastly, from memory, and John probably know, I think the audience for the news at 10 now is 50% of what it used to be. Yeah.
Agata.
Agata Kostinska, Center for Europe and European Trade, for the excellent presentation. I read the book with a great interest. I have a question. We have covered a lot how media reports Europe and EU, but I think that we haven't really touched upon what the EU institutions do or what they have been doing or they failed to do in order to reach out to the media and in order to actually kind of contribute to creating this public sphere. You, Sarah, touched a bit talking about the Spitzenkandidat, the idea of having a common debate which would be broadcasted also on the European basis by the EBS, I think, which I guess failed in some of the individual member states. But I was really interested in your views on what the EU institutions or European Commission could do to improve the EU coverage, not only by the, let's say, elite media, but also by the popular one. Mm-hmm. And just to comment a bit on this, I mean, we've seen some attempts in the recent in the new commission that it's going to take over from November. There have been some kind of attempts to restructure the communication services. There is an idea to reduce really the spokesperson for individual commissioners. Most of the new commissioners will be talking to press on their own, on a personal basis. So I would be very interested in your views on how the EU institutions could really reach out to reporters.
Great. Okay, so now we have lots of questions. We have background of journalists. Are Eurosceptics held to, Eurosceptics held to account in the same way as pre-Europeans? Ukraine, the failure of the EU institutions to reach out, have the Spitzenkandidat made a difference? And then one thing which ran through some of the other questions, maybe you could say a word about sort of changing media landscape and how that plays into the way Europe's covered. You touch on that in the book a little bit as well. And then perhaps Stephen's point, is it actually missing the point to talk about the way Brussels is covered? Shouldn't we be encouraging reporters to go out and cover the effects of Europe in the periphery, for example? Sarah, do you want to go first?
Well, many of these are obviously to the experts on my left and right. But I just want to return to something you mentioned in the beginning and also John mentioned in terms of, well, isn't the media just reporting accurately what has happened by this focus on, you know, the summits and the European Council? And I think that's both true and not true, because of course the European Council is the most important institution and were, particularly in the case of this sort of emergency politics. But this whole process has also empowered institutions within the EU, not least the European Central Bank, and also the European Commission to a certain extent. And if the job of journalists is to hold power to account, the focus should not just be on Merkel, in particular since it's hard for British and Greek voters to hold her to account, but also look at what these institutions, how they've been empowered. Because I think there's been the sort of democratic institutions, not least the European Parliament, has been a very weak player in all of this, but there are other supranational European institutions who've come out of this stronger in ways that I think they're also quite uncomfortable with, not least the ECB. So that's one thing. And just, I thought I should offer an answer on the Boris Johnson question. I'm not surprised he thinks he swayed the Danish referendum, but I think there's very little evidence to suggest that's the case.
Christina. Yeah.
No, what I think is that, as you say, I mean, it's very true. The moment Brussels stories stop being Brussels stories and start being like social stories from the capitals reporting about the effects of the European Union, and in an ideal world, having in Brussels people who really are watchdogs and hold power into account, I think would be a much more balanced coverage of the European Union. Also, to answer quickly to your question about holding into account Eurosceptics. The thing is that I think at the moment we have a little bit of a paradox, which is that we have an anti-European public sphere for the first time. I mean, there are many common points among Eurosceptics all over Europe. And it is like the trend of the moment to be kind of respectful and to make this very dangerous equation, thinking that Europe is like kind of an intellectual construction, but the truth is in Euroscepticism. So I'm always very shocked to see the lack of positive criticism. I mean, the moment you start criticizing Europe, it seems that it is the moment you start destroying it. Whereas I think we should be much more constructive in that. So I think at the moment there is a certain respect and fear of Eurosceptics, and they are pretty much left out of the limelight in terms of scrutiny.
Thank you. John?
Comment on one or two of these things. First, on the changing media landscape. I mean, we did put in a bit about this, about how the net and social media are changing the coverage. My impression, however, is, and we didn't go deeply enough into this, but my impression is that for most of the European correspondents, it's fairly minimal. The most famous blog, I think, is by the correspondent of Libération, who's a man called Jean Quatremer, who does a blog called Coulisses de Bruxelles, which is, I think, Brussels Offstage. And it's very much an insider's view, and is read by insiders faithfully, because Quatremer does, I think, more blogging than he does reporting for his ailing newspaper. And it's extremely informative. And others, I think, probably do the same, but we didn't have enough time to look into everybody. The crisis in Ukraine, Bill's point, has it brought people together? And there was another point about that as well. Like Hans, though he didn't give his reasons for saying he was skeptical about this, I'm also skeptical. I remember in the invasion of Iraq, Jürgen Habermas and Jacques Derrida coming out with a statement that this is Europe's public time. This is when Europe comes together against the illegal invasion of Iraq. And that didn't happen. And we're still talking about Europe coming together. I think the crisis in Ukraine and the quite different financial crisis has brought together, certainly in the second case, those who are members, the 17 members of the Euro. With Ukraine, one sees so Italy being much more skeptical about action than the UK, on the other hand. And each country, with Germany always regarded as being, rightly, as being the most powerful here, having rather a different view of Russia's actions. All, of course, condemn it. Whether or not they can come to any strong action against Russia, or to try to moderate what still is a continuing crisis, it's hard to say. On background of journalists, I think most journalists there would not have done European studies. They were mainly, I think, as journalists, certainly of sort of middle, older generation, probably arts graduates. Most, actually, I think, probably hadn't been to journalism school, as now younger journalists tend to be. There is a college, I'm not quite sure what it is, of European journalism, which has been anathematized, I think possibly with some justice, as being a place where journalists are trained to write positive stories about Europe. But I maybe Mark may put me right on that. The heartfelt plea about the sole Latvian correspondent that Stephen brought up, I mean, not plea so much, it's kind of the portrait of this man trying to cover everything.
It's a woman.
From
it's a lady.
Woman. Beg your pardon, this woman. is duplicated everywhere, and actually we make a point about the Greek coverage, because there's more than one Greek reporters, but not very many more than one, and they're all scrambling. They don't get paid much. Sometimes they don't get paid at all. They're all trying to cover a number of bases in order to get little bits of money from here and there. And yet their country, really one could say is of all countries, the one which needs most a good coverage from Europe. I talked to the Irish Times guy, who's now gone, who I think was the only Irish correspondent there. I don't think RTE has a permanent, I may be wrong in this, but he certainly was the only Irish newspaper man there. And he said he was working 16 hours a day for 2 years, and in the end actually had a nervous collapse and had to be withdrawn. The guy from Gazeta Wyborcza in Poland, I think, is the only Polish, again, I may be wrong on this, I think the only permanent staff Polish correspondent there. And he, too, he'd been in Russia before and said he went from famine to feast. Nobody would speak to him in Russia. and everybody wanted to speak to him in Brussels, but still he found almost impossible to put across to what is the main paper, I think, the biggest selling paper, the one that was created after 89 in Poland, put across the real stories, the complexity of the stories. Above all, German correspondents spoke to this, because they, the Die Zeit correspondent, said this very, very clearly and almost poignantly, that he was writing for an upmarket paper read by German intellectuals, able to report at some length, and yet he could not get across the sheer complexity of especially the financial mechanisms, the way in which Europe worked, and he didn't give up, but he kind of resigned himself after a year or so to not getting everything across and simply trying his best. I just wanted to pick up one thing from the Boris briefer there. You said that after a while we just stopped giving information.
You must get pictures.
Yeah, but I think that's with respect, sir, that's terrible. You have to keep on giving, even enemies, even people who are going to distort you and write stuff which they've made up on the tube, even then you have to keep on giving the stuff. And one thing we did find from people there, and of course we will not mention any names, who we talked to among the press corps there, but we spoke to quite a few, and all of them, one, it was clear they were experts, they knew what they were talking about, and secondly, they deeply hated the people who hated the European Union. And of course you can see their point. I mean, they're talking to people who they know are going to give them a hard time in the press. However, it seems to me that's the job. You just got to keep on smiling and saying, if you'd like another half hour on the common agricultural policy, I'm at your disposal. So I think that what remains in the European Union, in the Commission especially, is this, again, Christina mentioned it, and she saw it, because I haven't reported from Brussels. She saw that the early people especially, and still the officials there, see this with an idealistic vision. They see it as a place which is bringing and has assured peace in Europe. And they've got a lot of reason for saying so. And when journalists are properly skeptical or very skeptical or eurosceptical or downright hostile, they react, as it were, with a kind of a hurt, that these people are not seeing the moral good which we have encapsulated in Europe. And that, I think, leads to a kind of a distance and a problem, something of a problem, both for the Commission and the Union and for the reporters.
Thank you very much. I'm afraid we slightly overrun. Apologies for that. Thank you to Christina and to John for coming along and presenting the report, and to Sarah. Thank you all for your contributions. Speaking of Ukraine, we have another early morning discussion next Friday on Ukraine. I believe that's our next one. And we also have a discussion next this Thursday afternoon on German foreign policy, which John, amongst other people, is speaking at. So hope to see some of you there. Thank you.